in virtual bondage by him or those he protected. If men of goodwill would not step forward to war against evil, then who would? The spotlight I had put upon Leckenby had aided him, he said. Indeed it had. Yet it must have left disquiet in many minds, some of them official. From such a man, who was safe? Where was security when thieves and outlaws could run at large, doing their will of the populace? For a long time I lay on my back upon the bed, my hands clasped behind my head, thinking of what I might do, and how the last piece must be written. To indict Leckenby was not enough. I must support my claims with arguments, with facts, with names, dates, and places. I knew this sort of thing was little done, but it must be done in this case. I doubted I would have more than one chance, so all must be done at once. Also, I must be about my business. Already, I had been over long in London, my progress only adequate. Many men of my age were already captains of ships, commanders of regiments, and active in political life. Charles Danvers, at 18, had been elected to Parliament, and many another had done as well. I had no preferment, so must make my own way. But this was a time of change, when many yeomen and less were coming to high place through their energies alone. Mentally, I began to calculate. My little ventures had all but one returned me a small profit. The major investment was aboard the Good Catherine, now due into port. Item by item, I calculated what I possessed, and it came to a tidy sum. I had succeeded in saving something in excess of £25, and this at a time when a hard-working playwright might earn £30 in a year. And this counted nothing of my current venture on the Good Catherine. Carefully, I studied my situation and decided what I must buy. Now I knew the sources of the stuff of trade. I knew where to buy the brightly coloured cloths, the copper bells, and the edged tools, and where to obtain them at the least cost. At last I slept, restless with thoughts of all that must be done, but eager for the morrow. Awakening suddenly with the first light, it was in my thoughts that I must no longer live so solitary, but must make friends. For if trouble came, I had none to speak for me, while Ralph Leckenby could call his friends by the dozen. No sooner did I come on the street than Paget was there. "You are famous," he said. "The talk of London." "I?" "Your victory over Captain Tankard. He was a man much feared, and one with many enemies. There is much talk of your gallant conduct against him." "I fought to save my life." "That may be, but you are much spoken of, and there is a man about, waiting for you." He was a servant in livery, at a glass of ale in the common room. He came to his feet when I entered. "I am from Sir George Clifford, the Earl of Cumberland," he announced. "I am asked to accompany you to him. He would speak with you." Yet it was to no great castle that I was taken, but to a place upon the river bank where Clifford was seeing to the outfitting of his ship, the Elizabeth Bonaventure. He gave me a quick glance. "You are the man who defeated Tankard?"
"I am."
"Know you aught of the sea?"
"Of small craft only. I am from the Hebrides."
"Ah, fine sailormen those. Well, wish you to serve with me? There is word of a great armada the Spanish are sending against us."
"I know of it."
He threw me a quick glance.
"What do you know?"
"That Spain is preparing more than 100 ships.
Some have gathered in Cadiz, even now.
Thousands of men are recruited, and more than 2,000 brass cannon, with much else."
"How does it come that you know all this? There has been talk, of course, but—"
"I have ventured some small sums in trade. Thus, I try to be aware of what is happening at sea. I have myself been contemplating a voyage to America, and to that end have spent much time talking with sailors and fishermen along the shore. There are no secrets there,
Would you serve with me, then? England will need every man.
He paused.
And I want bold ones, for when the Armada is defeated, and we shall defeat them, I wish to sail for the Indies, for the Spanish waters.
I would be honored to serve with you in any capacity that befits a gentleman, I replied.
Could you command a prize vessel, if need be?
I could.
Good. Provide yourself with what you need, and report to me here.
And, he added sharply,
no more dueling.
Her Majesty does not look with favor upon such things.
He smiled then, friendly enough.
Although I should like to have seen that duel.
He changed the subject.
You have written some booklets?
I have.
Then keep your eyes and ears open. I should like this story well told when it is over.
I want a report to the Queen, but I shall want more,
a pamphlet, to go out over the city, recounting the story of the Elizabeth.
It would be a pleasure.
As indeed it would. I had never written of a battle, and this would be one, perhaps the first of many, that I should not only witness, but partake of. Yet I knew little enough of what my duties would be, nor of command afloat. It behooved me to learn as much as I could.
I hurried back to my room at the inn to make my plans.
I should need pistols, some clothes fit for the sea, books for reading, and most of all, the help of an old salt, if such there was about, who could talk to me of battles at sea and their conduct. When I came down from my room, Tosti arose to meet me.
"Do you have a patron?" he asked.
"A patron?" I laughed.
"No, not I.
Patrons are for poets or playwrights, not for mere scribblers."
"No, I am recruited to war against the Spanish dons."
I explained to Tosti what lay before me, and he went with me while I purchased two excellent pistols and the equipment and materials for charging them. For several days I was busy, yet I took the time needed to write the final piece on Ray Fleckenby. Being no literary craftsman, I did my best with what came to mind. I wrote it as a story from some ancient land, yet kept the subject so close that none could miss what I intended. I entitled it, A True Relation of How a Master Thief Became a Great Lord. Writing in words that implied a long-ago story in a distant land, I yet painted so close a picture that none could fail to recognize Ralph Fleckenby. I told of his plotting to become the thief-master and controller of bawds. Then, almost using Ralph's own words, I told how he would become a knight and then a lord of the realm. At last I pictured him fat and gloating, so strong that not even the ruler could displace him. During those last days, I threw myself into the task of preparing for sea with all my energies. The problems were new for me, but I quickly perceived what must be done. And by discreet questions and observation, I learned much. I directed the loading of supplies, food, extra canvas, and I watched the storage of powder and shot. In every way, I attempted to make myself useful. Clifford might wish for bold men, but useful men were just as necessary. We put to sea in company with a number of other vessels, many of whose names I never knew or heard but in passing. My life aboard ship was brief and hectic. The Spanish were coming, this much we knew. My informants along the Thames had known much from the gossip of fishermen and sailors of coastwise or across channel boats, many of whom operated, regardless of war or threat of war. Lying low in the water, their fast-sailing craft swept back and forth across the channel, many of them engaged in smuggling or other clandestine activities. But the servants of Elizabeth would have done well to have listening posts among them. Drake, I believed, did just that. The Bonaventure was a good sailor, as for weeks she proved, as we beat back and forth across the channel, and sometimes off the coast of Brittany. But never a Spanish sail did we see. We put back into port to renew our stores.
there were stories that Sir John Hawkins was now to command the vessel. As soon as we dropped anchor, I made it ashore to see Emma Delahaye.
Ah, she looked up from her table as I entered. It is you. Have you not heard, then?
Heard? What?
There is an order for your arrest. It seems you have offended someone.
An order for my arrest?
For a moment, I seemed to turn cold. It was what I had feared. Once they had me in prison, they would somehow, some way, discover who I was, and I would be killed. If not by the Queen's men, then by those of Leckenby or his protector. How much could I trust Emma Delahaye? No matter. I had no choice. Only a moment passed, but I knew what I must do. What of the good Catherine?
She lies yonder. She has discharged her cargo and is reloading.
My venture?
You may see the accounts. You have £55 due you.
Your captain did well.
When does he sail again?
Within the week. She shuffled some papers upon her table. There is a place aboard her, if you wish.
She paused then.
It would be safer, Tatton.
It was the first time she had called me by my given name.
If you wish to make a venture, she said, you could go with it and learn the trade for yourself.
He is a wise man who does not overstay his time.
I shall go, I said.
Be aboard by the Sunday coming,
and be careful.
I would, indeed.
Chapter 23. What, then, to do? The Queen's men wished to arrest me. Something contrived, no doubt, by Leckenby's protector. Or had they discovered my true identity? There was always that danger. A danger I would never be without. With honour, I could not simply leave Sir George Clifford. Yet to remain about when the order for my arrest was made out was to ask for trouble. I went straight away to him. He received me at once and sat back in his chair.
If you have asked to see me at this time, he said, it cannot but be serious.
What is it? Risking arrest there and by him, if my crime, whatever it was, proved serious, I told him simply what had been done. I spoke of the broadsides and pamphlets I had written, and now of the order for my arrest. Of course, I said nothing of my Irish ancestry, trusting not even him so much. I knew somewhat of the man, the Queen's champion he was, but he had also lived a wild, reckless life himself, and at present had his own troubles. He listened patiently.
They will not arrest you while you serve me, he said after a bit. And no doubt you are safer here. Yet if you wish to go, then go you may. However, I would suggest you serve me yet a while. You have spoken of your wish to make money with your ventures. It is my wish also. But believe me, Chantrey, one good prize and we should all be rich. I need money as much as any man, and I mean to have that prize. Little I knew how much my life depended on the decision I was then to make, yet what might have happened if I had chosen otherwise. I only know my entire life was changed when I decided. How often it is that a whim may alter the course of our existences. How often the simple decision whether to go right or left when one leaves a doorway can change so much. A man may turn to the right and walk straight away into all manner of evil, and to the left, all manner of good. It was ever my way to push forward, and ever my way to hold to a bargain. My word once given was precious to me, and I had promised to serve with him.
Sir George, I said, I dare not be arrested. I do wish to serve you, and to serve England in this hour. Yet to be arrested would be fatal. I paused, not wishing to explain why it might be fatal. I trumped up a reason, and logical enough it was too. I am convinced that I am to be arrested only to be murdered, that once in prison I would be set upon, when unarmed, by Leckenby's felons.
Have no fear. You shall go aboard my ship, and no officer will reach you there, if I have to go to Elizabeth herself to protect you. Look you, I have many men, but most serve in hope of prize money, of gaining my attention and hence preferment. Some are mere loiterers, putting in their time. Some are lusty fighters, who have often proved their courage and strength. But none has taken hold as you have done. Within the short time you have served me, you have laid hold of problems and solved them. You know much of the ship's care and husbandry. Any task I set for you, I need never think of again, for it is done. You have proved yourself my strong right hand, and already I have mentioned you to Sir John Hawkins, if he should take command. And he may? It is possible. The Queen wants me nearby, although I should prefer to be at sea. Well, one more voyage, perhaps. At least one more. He looked up at me suddenly, then glanced about to see if others were near. Gendry, I shall give you this word and no other, because I wish you to remain with me. I have word, very secret word, of the sailing of a great Spanish vessel, loaded with treasure. I hope to seize that vessel. He took up a bottle and filled two wine glasses, putting one of them before me. Gendry, I will tell you this much. I have an Irish friend. Oh, do not look surprised. I have an Irish friend who now serves Spain. The information comes from him. We have much trouble with Ireland. Most of the Irish would gladly burn England to the dust. But a very important... But they do not wish anyone else to do it. As one of them once said to me, the English are our enemies, but they are our enemies. We do not wish to share them with others. Amusing, is it not? Yet I trust this man, and he has told me of this great vessel coming. When? He shrugged. I know not, only that she will come, and we must be out there waiting. Will you have further word? Perhaps, I doubt it. Word is not so easy to receive. Possibly you, with your riverfront friends, might learn something. But the less it is talked of, the better. Look what I have to contend with. Not only the Spanish, but so many of our own people, who would love to find such a juicy plum, ready to fall from the tree. I have a fine ship, but I am not Drake, nor Frobisher, nor... But you may be Hawkins. He smiled. That I may be. But even he does not know of this yet. I will stay with you, Sir George. Good. He held out his hand. I thought you might. Now go and finish up whatever it is you have to do, and return swiftly, for I think we shall wait but little longer, and then return to sea. Leaving my plumed hat aboard, I chose a dark cloak and a flat cap to wear ashore. Then, armed with my sword, a dagger, and two charged pistols, I went ashore again, and made my way to the place of Emma Delahaye. Swiftly as could be, I arranged my business with her. £60 in goods I trusted to her. Do the best you can. When this is over, I shall be back. If I come not back immediately, do you administer my funds to my best interest, and hold the profits for me, for eventually I shall come. I wonder what strange hint of disaster caused me so to phrase it. Surely I knew nothing. To my thinking, I was but being cautious, having no knowledge of all that would transpire, before I came across this threshold again. The Bonaventure went again to sea, and I with her. Fair blew the winds, and the sails filled as we breasted the seas for the French coast. Some Spanish ships were reported there, and beating their way north for England. But we found them not, so Sir George changed course, and stood away to the south for the Azores, casting about for prey. Owner of vast estates, he was encumbered with debts, and a rich prize might make up for all he had wasted in wild living.
As he grew older, he had also grown wiser, and wished to establish himself once more. Vessels laden with treasure from the Indies or the coast of America might be along soon, and it was one of these we sought. We had been but 10 days at sea, when, just as dawn was breaking, I heard the cry from the masthead.
"Sail ho!"
"Where away?"
3 points abaft the beam."
Our bows came around, and we headed down toward her. She was a fair tall ship, a Spanish galleon, fresh from the Indies by the look of her. The decks were cleared for action, and we rounded to. As we came alongside, we let go with a broadside that toppled the foremast, and shot away a piece of the bowsprit. We closed in then, and Sir George motioned me.
"You will lead the boarding party. Secure control of the vessel and make repairs at once. Then keep in our company and prepare to assist."
As we came alongside, I jumped to the rigging. Followed by members of the boarding party, I made ready for the attack. Men were swarming her deck, but much destruction had been done by our broadside, and whoever stood upon the poop deck seemed to have lost command. As one man, we swung in close and over the narrowing gap. There was a brief, fierce struggle as we landed. A man rushed at me, swinging a cutlass. I greeted him with a thrust, then fired a pistol at a second man. Two more closed in about me, but one of them fell before the blade of one of our crewmen, a husky lad from Yorkshire. We drove them back, and I noticed a slackening of effort on a part of the crew. Men who appeared to be Basques. A dozen of these had grouped together. Suddenly, as one man, they dropped their swords and surrendered. One of them, a tall blonde lad with a splendid set of shoulders, merely handed me his sword.
"Captain, we were forced to see. None of us wished for this.
Get forward, then. And if it seems to you the mast can be re-stepped and made useful until it can be replaced, save it. If not, cut it away. Do you and your mates stay forward. Give us good service, and you shall be freed." They went quickly forward. Elsewhere, the fighting had well nigh ceased. Here or there, some hardened soul held to his blade. I disliked seeing good men die, and persuaded some to surrender. On the poop, the young officer awaited me. Near him lay two bodies, of whom one must have been the sailing master, though I knew nothing of the command on a Spanish vessel. The other appeared to be the second in command. The officer could be no more than 16, one of those given command, no doubt, due to family and prestige, with carefully chosen lieutenants who could carry the burden for him. Our fire had killed both. And now he was alone. A handsome lad, too, standing straight and pale with shock, but with no fear in him.
"You have taken my vessel,"
he said, staring at me in an incredulous manner. The shock was still on him, for our broadside had been remarkably effective. Fortunate for me, unfortunate for him.
"It was my first command,
and this is mine. If you give me your word to cause no trouble, I shall not imprison you."
"Of course, Captain. You have my word."
"Captain?"
It was Wilsey, one of my own men.
"Look!"
4 ships were bearing down upon us, although still some distance away. We had, in the short time since boarding the Spanish vessel, become separated from the Bonaventure, which was hull down over the horizon. The oncoming Spanish vessels looked to cut us off.
"Wilsey, get the prisoners below, all but those working on the forecastle, and make ready the guns."
Again I glanced at the oncoming ships, and at our own vessel.
"Tell Brooks, I said to get some sail on her."
Of commanding such a vessel at sea, I knew little, scarcely more than the Spanish Don from whom I had taken command. Nor had Sir George intended to leave me in command, I am sure. He had no doubt expected to come aboard and straighten matters out himself before we proceeded with our mission. Now, I was alone. ordering the young Spanish officer below. I moved swiftly to get the decks cleared and to pull away from the oncoming Spanish vessels. To escape from them meant also to draw away from the Bonaventure. Yet there was no other way. I went below to the cabin, which was beautifully furnished. Disconsolate, the young officer sat slumped in a chair.
"Do not despair," I told him. "You shall be treated as a gentleman."
"But I have failed." "One failure is not a lifetime, and this was no fault of yours. Remain here. I must go on deck." With our foremast gone, and much of our rigging damaged, I swiftly realized our chances of escape were few. Darkness was hours away. As I emerged upon the deck, Brooks came to me.
"Captain, we are in a bad way. With the foremast gone and damage to the rigging, we can scarcely make steerage way without repairs."
He glanced astern.
"They'll be up with us long before we can get any sail on her to speak of."
"The guns?"
"Six of them, out of action."
"Our men?"
"No losses. 22 men aboard, Captain. Only some minor cuts and scratches. Nothing serious."
His face was stiff.
"We've no chance, Captain. They'll come up to us within the hour. Two at most."
My thoughts raced, seeking every possible solution. Capture for the crew meant a Spanish prison, with small chance of escape or ransom. Capture for me meant the same, but the crew were my responsibility. The vessel moved easily upon the water. It was not a rough sea, and the wind was fair.
"Brooks, would you rather chance capture or an open boat for England? It can't be more than 2 days' sail."
"An open boat?" His face changed as if by magic. The eagerness was apparent.
"You mean now?"
"They wouldn't be apt to pursue, and..."
"We'd chance it, Captain. I can speak for them. We'd all chance it."
"All right, then. Food and water, Brooks. Get the longboat over the side, out of sight of the Spaniards. Arm yourselves. But if they pursue, don't resist, and I will do what I can for you. But you've a good chance to get away." He left on the run, and I turned to the Spanish captain. Of his language, I knew a good bit, for Spanish smugglers were often off the Irish coast when I was a lad, and their officers had often visited us at my father's home. Those who would be career soldiers went elsewhere, a career with their own army or the British being out of the question.
"Your name, Captain?"
"Don Vicente Uvalde y Padilla."
"I am Tatten Chantry."
"Don Vicente, you have lost your ship. Do you wish to regain it?" His eyes lit with hope.
"Regain it? How?"
"It is a matter of honour, Don Vicente. I will surrender the vessel to you if you will give me your word not to pursue my crew, allowing them to put off in the longboat." He looked at me for a long moment, thinking it out.
"My ship is damaged," he said. "Too badly damaged, perhaps. You foresee capture, yet you think of your men."
"We could stay and make a fight of it, Don Vicente. We might lose.
Our other ships..." The plural was only a slight shading of the truth.
"May come up to our aid, and they may not. I wish to save my men."
"And you, Captain Chantry?"
"I would surrender myself to you. To you personally, a Spanish gentleman."
He smiled.
"Ah, Captain, you are shrewd. I am permitted to show myself the victor. Your crew escapes, and you become my prisoner, trusting to my honour."
"Exactly.
How close are our ships?" he asked.
"Close," I admitted. He laughed, delighted.
"Oh, this is beautiful, beautiful. I must remember it, Captain."
He looked thoughtful.
"Your flag is flying, Captain.
I think we had better lower it before our ships open fire."
"By all means," I agreed.
"I have your word?"
"You do.
You do indeed." On deck, my first glance was off the starboard side. The longboat was there in the water, sail up, making good speed. She was even now a few hundred yards off.
I glanced at the Spanish ships. Slower, heavier to handle. They would need another half hour at least, probably more. By that time, the longboat would be over the horizon and out of sight. Turning, I looked at Don Vicente. Already he had opened the hatch, and his men were emerging on deck. He studied me a moment, his eyes cold and measuring. Yet whatever came, nothing could help me now. For better or worse, I was his prisoner. Chapter 24. A prisoner I truly was. Yet surely no prisoner was ever treated better. Whatever Don Vicente's position, his influence must have been great, for his decisions in my case were not refused. He explained simply that his ship had been severely injured by our broadside, that we had taken the ship, and that he had negotiated its release and a surrender by me on the consideration that the crew be released. His brother officers accepted me as an equal, and from the first I was well treated. In the weeks at sea, constantly using Spanish, my command of the tongue improved. It is a beautiful language, and having ever a love for the music of words, I enjoyed speaking it. We came at last to Cadiz. As our ship dropped anchor in the ancient harbour, I felt a twinge of dismay. Aboard ship, all had been well, but this was the Spain of our enemies, the Spain of the Inquisition. What would become of me now? Not long was I kept waiting, for a vessel put out from shore and came alongside. The officer who came up the ladder was a sharp-visaged man of perhaps 40, looking every inch the soldier.
Don Vicente, I am Captain Enrique Martinez. I have come for the prisoner.
You have come for him? The man is my prisoner, Captain. Mine. I took him. I shall keep him. At least until such a time as ransom has been arranged for.
But I did not think...
That is right, Captain. You did not think. Now you will have time for it. Let me repeat, the prisoner is mine. I might add, he will also be my guest. If your superiors feel it necessary, they can find him where I am. He started to turn away, but the captain spoke again.
Don Vicente, I regret.
Please do not. Regret is a vain thing, my friend, and you no doubt have pressing duties elsewhere. I might add for your personal information that when I was briefly his prisoner, I was treated as a gentleman, and while he is my prisoner, he too will be so treated. His poise and coolness were remarkable. I stood very quietly as Don Vicente walked away upon other business.
I am sorry, Captain Martinez, I said, but this was the agreement we made.
He shrugged.
Of course. I understand, Captain, and might add that you are fortunate indeed. I am sure no prisoner Spain has ever taken will be better treated. Don Vicente and his family are noble in every sense.
He shrugged.
I was but doing my duty.
He paused again.
You may have trouble with the forces of Inquisition, for they are less likely to honor Don Vicente.
The home of Don Vicente was more elegant than any I had ever seen. The apartment to which I was shown was furnished sparsely, but well. He was younger than I, Don Vicente, a handsome man and an only child. Once we were in his home, we talked much. We wandered throughout the world in our long conversations. But then, one day he spoke to me of ransom. It was a question I had dreaded. For who would pay ransom for me? I was alone. I had no one. Some captains and leaders of men, such as Sir John Hawkins, had been known to arrange ransom for prisoners. But I had scarcely been a month at sea when this had happened. The Earl of Cumberland? But what was I to him? Nor was he a man of great wealth. Although he possessed vast estates, they were heavily encumbered. There was no one to come to my aid. My own small investments would pay no ransom. Once this was understood, my chances of release would be few, or even of staying where I was. The Spanish, no doubt, thought me a young man of great wealth,
and I had nothing.
I do not know, Don Vicente, I told him. My family were Irish, and they were destroyed in the wars.
He looked at me gravely.
To be without family is bad. How then did you live?
As best I could, I replied. I had thought to be a soldier and win a way to command.
But is it not your custom to buy your commands?
It is, but sometimes...
Ah!
He exclaimed suddenly.
You are Irish. I know an Irishman. He is a general among us. General Hugo O'Connor.
Startled, I looked up.
But I know him. And he knows me. Is it possible to see him then? But of course. He is my very good friend, and a most able man. Come, we will go to him.
On the way, Don Vicente related several stories about the general. He had long lived in Spain, was much admired there, and was no longer thought of as other than Spanish. He had done well at the wars and lived in the finest style, and he was much trusted by the king.
The house itself was Moorish, undoubtedly one of those taken over from the Moors when they were driven out. The walls were stark and plain, with only a few high, barred windows looking out upon the street.
The houses were largely square, with a central patio in which grew flowers and vines, usually around a fountain. The ground floor rooms opened upon the patio, and the upper story possessed a continuous balcony, offering access to all the upper rooms. In summer, when the heat was great, the patio was cooled by water, sprinkled on its pavement. We pulled a cord that sounded a bell inside. After a short wait, we were admitted to a dark, cool passage. The floor of tile in an interesting pattern. The walls covered with religious paintings. We were shown to a drawing room on the first floor, its walls adorned with tapestries. As the weather was cool, a fire burned on the hearth. Several braziers were standing about also, containing olive stones, which burned with very little odour. We had scarcely entered when the door at the other side of the room opened, and the general stepped in. He was a tall, powerfully made man, thickening slightly about the waist, but a man of commanding presence. He was dark and swarthy, black Irish, as I was in most of my ancestry. He wore a pointed beard, carefully trimmed, and moustaches. He was dressed now in black, with a heavy gold chain around his neck, and a gold-hilted sword. He glanced first at me, then started to speak to Don Vicente. Then he paused, looking back at me.
Do I not know you?
Don Hugo, Don Vicente said. I wish you to meet Captain Tatton Chantry. He was taken by me from a British ship. He has said that he knows you. For a moment, I was in a quandary. The name Tatton Chantry would mean nothing to this man, yet he had seemed to recognize me.
Do not be surprised at the name. I spoke in Gaelic. It is one I have chosen to wear. He who owned it is now dead. He died at our house, in fact, long ago.
Hugo O'Connor studied me carefully.
It cannot be that you are...
No.
No. They are all killed.
My father was killed. I escaped. I was advised, General, to tell my name to no one. But I must assume that it is known to you. Do you remember Ballycarbery?
It was near there, was it?
He spoke in Gaelic and looked at me again.
Aye, you have the look of them. Great fighters all, and strong men, but thoughtful men too. Aye, but how did you escape?
The story is over long for the telling here, I said, also in Gaelic. I am Don Vicente's prisoner, and he has spoken of ransom. I have no money and no friends. I have lived by trade and a little by writing. I have some ventures now at sea, but unless I return to England...
To England? You are daft, lad.
If they find you, it is the headsman's axe or hanging. Nonetheless, I intend to buy back the land that was mine, or a part of it. I wish to live again where we did when you came to visit us,
when you hunted upon the moors with my father. It is my home, and I long for the view of the sea there, the rocky shores and the high meadows. I will have it again, General.
Aye,
he said gloomily.
I miss it myself.
But come, we cannot carry on in Gaelic and leave our friend standing. He turned to Don Vicente. I do know him, and I cannot thank you enough for behaving toward him as you have done. You have been gracious and considerate. He paused. It is a delicate matter, Don Vicente. This man is no ordinary seafaring man, nor even a soldier. He is of the blood royal, although a man without domains. Don Vicente shrugged.
I guessed as much. He has the manner.
We seated ourselves, and our talk was in Spanish, and pleasant enough it was. General O'Connor, I found to be an urbane and charming gentleman, a skilful politician, as well as a military man. To have survived and advanced himself to his present status in a foreign country was proof enough of that.
We must talk again, he said finally. Do you come when you can?
To Don Vicente, he said,
we can certainly reach some understanding.
2 days later, we met again.
You must have a care,
O'Connor warned me, for there are spies about.
Spies for the Inquisition?
Yes. You are Irish. If they suspect who you are, you will be murdered. There are also those in Spain who are spies for England. They suspect all Irishmen of plotting against England, so all are suspect.
I am not thought to be Irish, but from the Hebrides.
Ah, a nice thought, that. It may help. In the meanwhile, what is it you wish to do?
To return to England. I have my ventures there.
I am afraid that will be impossible. Ransom can be arranged, I think, and luckily for you, Don Vicente is your friend. However, even he is powerless against the Inquisition. And no matter what your beliefs, they will wish to question you if you should draw attention to yourself. There are those among them who do not take kindly to any foreigner in their land. Even we, who fight for Spain, are suspect. Where then should I go? What should I do? I would suggest the Lowlands. I am taking a detachment of troops to join the Duke of Parma there. You will volunteer. That will take you away from their eyes to where much can be done. You are very kind.
Kind?
No, not kind. We Irish serving abroad have learned we must stand together. You are one of us, even though what your family was, they will never be again. Not in the lifetime of any who now live, at least. We talked the hours away, and planned the steps that must be taken. If I were to volunteer to serve in the Spanish army, no thought of ransom would remain, although a small indemnity might have to be paid. I knew naught of such matters, and left negotiations in the hands of General O'Connor, who had much experience. In the meanwhile, I fenced each day, and rode with Don Vicente over his estates in the country. By night I read much in the admirable library Don Vicente possessed. I say possessed, but this was all he did with the books, for I discovered with some surprise that he could not read, disdaining the practice as not befitting a gentleman. The library had been in the home when it was taken by his grandfather from the moors. Some of the books were in Arabic, of which I knew nothing, but most were in Latin, at which I was proficient. Yet every day and every night I bethought me of ways by which I might escape once I had reached the Lowlands, for my only wish was to return to England and my ventures, such as they might be. And each day in Spain I must walk with care, for I was free only upon a whim of circumstance, and might at any time be imprisoned. Carefully, I had avoided women. In England, those I met were not the sort who appealed to me. Those I was meeting in Spain were ladies of great houses and ladies of the court.
To give attention to such women, even if they wished for it, was to incur trouble from some other less favoured man. And true it was that with Don Vicente and General O'Connor, I constantly met women, many of whom were lovely. Although I was permitted to move about with seeming freedom, I knew I was not free, that I was under observation most, if not all, the time. My movements, comments, and actions were subject to scrutiny. Meanwhile, I was learning a good deal about the Spanish army from General O'Connor. "Many Germans and Irish serve with us," he explained. "Young Spanish men of good family wish to avoid service, as do many of the others. A few years ago, volunteers thronged to serve, but now they grow fewer. Yet it is a good army, and the men are well trained." "How long?" I asked him. "Will it remain so if the citizens themselves do not wish to serve?" "In ancient Rome, the mercenaries soon controlled the government, and I hear it has been so in other places as well." The general shrugged. "I ask only to serve. When we lack for government or army of our own, some of us must needs find careers where we can. I am loyal to Spain, because it is Spain that gave me opportunity to be so. But you are right. Those who do not wish to be bothered with service to their country soon find there are others only too willing to occupy the places they shun. Those who shunned service soon become the servants rather than the masters." Suddenly I was restless. Too long had I remained inactive, and I wished to be about my business. I was never one who could spend my days in social activity, no matter how pleasant. I said as much. "Soon," O'Connor said, "we are preparing now to send men to the lowlands. I shall see that you are among the first to go." He paused then, walking to the window that overlooked the narrow street. "You know," he suggested, "there are worse lives than this. You have started well. You have made a place for yourself here. Don Vicente likes you. You were important to him as evidence of his first success. But he obviously likes you personally, as does his family. They have great power here, and I am sure your every success would be considered a success of their own." "That may be as you suggest," I replied. "But my future must be elsewhere. I must return to my own country." "Sooner or later, they would find you out." "That may be, but there I must go. I will serve with you, and serve you well. But sooner or later I must return to Ireland." "Very well." He buckled his sword. "It is time for me to go. You are meeting Don Vicente?" "I am. We are going to some races. A moment." O'Connor lifted a hand. "I have been meaning to warn you. There are family feuds here in Spain as well as in Ireland, and Don Vicente and his family have enemies. Only last night, one of my people informed me that Don Vicente is in grave danger. He is fiercely proud, as are all Hidalgos. His enemies intend to destroy him, and with him, the pride of his family. For as you know, he is an only child." "Destroy him? How?" "One of their number is Don Fernand Sarmiento. He is one of the finest swordsmen in Spain, and lately returned to Spain from France, where I understand he killed two men in duels. For one reason or another, he is desperate to establish a pretext for challenging Don Vicente." "You are sure of this?" "I am. One of the principal ways of remaining secure in a country not your own is to be aware, to know where the power lies, and what moves are being made. Long ago, I established my own lines of communication. Believe me, my information is reliable." I considered what General O'Connor had said and debated what best I might do. Warn my friend? That would do no good, for his pride was such that he would not flee from danger, or even try to avoid it. In fact, to warn him
might only precipitate the situation I would be trying to avoid. I had fenced much with Don Vicente, and held my skill from sight, careful not to seem too proficient, but to let him have the better of me at times. After all, he was my friend, and what had I to gain by proving myself better than he? With a skilled swordsman for an enemy, Don Vicente would have no chance at all. The place we'd elected to start out for the races could scarcely have been worse. It was at the top of the Calle Mayor, where stood the Church of San Felipe El Real, where people of the arts, writers, painters, dramatists, and others of the theatre, were wont to meet. Mingled with them were young gallants of the town, soldiers home from the wars, and many another who called himself soldier, but who avoided any battle other than those found in taverns or boudoirs. Standing there, awaiting Don Vicente's arrival, I listened to the talk and laughter, the witticisms and attempts at such, with only a piece of my mind. Rather, I wondered what it was I should do. Don Vicente's conduct toward me had been most courteous. Without his influence, I should have been in prison, or pulling an oar in a galley. Suddenly I heard a strange voice behind me. "Luis, this is my friend, Don Fernand Sarmiento." "A pleasure, senor," said the man named Luis. "You are to be in Madrid for long?"
"A few days only. I regret, but it is true. A small mission here, and then I shall return to Malaga."
Another voice broke in. "Quiet now. He comes." And indeed, I saw Don Vicente approaching. They must have known of his coming, and been awaiting him here. He must often come this way. That might be it. But there might also be a spy in his household. Someone in Vicente's own establishment. Yet the servants whom I knew were fiercely loyal, or seemed to be. Don Vicente came up the steps.
"Dad, you are here before me. I am sorry, for I would not have you wait."
"Think nothing of it," I said. "Down the street there is a place." Don Fernand had turned sharply, bumping into Don Vicente. Instantly, I stepped between them. "Señor," I spoke sharply, "you are rude." For a moment he hesitated, his eyes going from Don Vicente to me. It was Vicente with whom he wanted to quarrel, not I. He was a narrow-visaged man, with piercing black eyes, and a face somewhat pucked, a lean and savage man.
"Out of my way," he said. "I have no business with you."
"But you do, senor. And you have a sword with which to conduct it." Trapped, he glared at me. Dropping his hand to the hilt of his sword, he spoke in what he meant to be a menacing tone.
"Once more, senor, I command you. Step aside. I do not wish to kill you."
Chapter 25.
"Have no worries, senor. It will be my pleasure to see that you do not."
He frowned, furious, yet hesitant. It was Don Vicente whom he intended to kill. Who in God's name was I, this interloper, this stranger?
"Who are you?" he said. "I know you not."
"Captain Tatton Chantry, senor. At your service, if you are not a coward."
"A coward? For that I'll..."
"But not on the steps of a church, senor. There must be a secluded corner where we can enjoy the festivities."
"In the alleyway, then, and I'll slit your gullet."
"What has come over you?"
Don Vicente was astonished. He sought to evade the quarrel. Another man, a slim and handsome fellow with red moustaches, had come to stand beside us.
"It was you, senor," he said to Vicente. "It was you, I believe, he wanted. The man is a famous matón, a killer for hire."
Don Vicente's lips tightened.
"If it was I he sought, then it is I who must fight him."
"I am sorry, my friend," I said gently.
It may have been you he intended to fight, but it is I who named him a coward. Therefore, I must give him satisfaction. That is the way of it, our new friend said, and then he added, I am Tommaso Crowley, an officer in His Spanish Majesty's service. He bowed slightly. I have heard your name spoken, Captain Chantry. We are to be brother officers in the Lowlands, I believe. If you please, I should like to be your second in this affair. I accept the offer. Shall we go? I have no wish to keep them waiting. Turning to Vicente, I said quietly, Keep your back to the wall. It is you they wished to kill, and he may have others with him. The alley was a cool and quiet place, and secluded. As I approached, Don Fernand Sarmiento had drawn his sword and was waiting. Come, let us have done with this, he exclaimed impatiently. You, Senor, whoever you are, on guard. I was young, and he who faced me older. It was his mistake that he coupled my youth with the assumption that I must also be inexperienced and therefore impetuous. He was cool, adept, and disdainful. My whole intent had one purpose, to catch him out of time, for timing is of the greatest importance. My opponent was a killer, hired for the task, yet I was not his prey. Therefore, he wished to be rid of me quickly. In several brief exchanges, he seemed to have the better of me. Yet I had learned to trust to my subconscious instinct for the proper moment of attack. When it came, he lunged. His recovery was a little slow, but my riposte was not. My cut was for the cheek, but my point was a bit low. Or perhaps he shifted his head at just the wrong instant. My point struck his jawbone and was deflected downward. He took 4 inches of my blade through his neck. My withdrawal was instantaneous, but already he was choking on his own blood. I stepped back, blade still on guard. And it was well that I kept it so, for in one wild, vicious effort, he swung the edge of his sword at me with a wide cut, in a desperate effort to take me with him. My blade caught his and deflected it, although the power of the cut was staggering. He stumbled forward, his own point striking the pavement as he fell. Then he rolled over, face upward, his ruff stained red with blood, his eyes already glazing. I think, O'Crowley suggested, we had best be away from here. Just one thing more, I said, my naked blade still in my hand. You who came with him, tell your master there is to be no more of this. If other matones are sent to do his bloody work, tell him that I shall seek him out, and he shall pay, not such as this. I gestured toward Sarmiento. A few minutes later, we sat in a small bodega, or tavern. A glass of wine, O'Crowley suggested. Or would you prefer some chocolate? Chocolate was a drink newly arrived from the Indies, and one very popular in Spain, where they drank it at all hours. The Spanish also drank wine, I had noted, but rarely to excess. Wine first, I said, and then perhaps some chocolate. I felt the need of nothing, and was shaken. What I wished for most was simply to be still, to recover myself a bit. For swordsman though I was, and certainly no novice to fighting and bloodshed, I liked it not. How did you know what he was about? Vicente asked me. For no, you did. I was forewarned, and so ready. You risked your life for me. You are my friend. You have been gracious. I knew that you would fight, but I also knew that the man was certain to be very dangerous. Yet you fought him. My training, I commented dryly, has been good. We Irish are an embattled race, and I have almost as many enemies as you have. Nevertheless, my friend, I said to Vicente, you are of great courage. This I saw when first we met. You would have fought bravely, but Sarmiento,
was a professional assassin, and it needs more than courage against such a one. Courage without the fighting.